And the way we do that, the way we look for supersymmetry at the LHC, is primarily through looking for the colored superpartners, so the superpartners with IC3 charges. So here's a kind of a cartoon of a typical initial state. So the LHC collides two protons. So these protons, as you all know, are composite objects. And you can imagine getting, let's say, a pair of gluons out of the two protons when they collide. So that the high-energy proton-proton collision corresponds to a high-energy gluon-gluon collision. I think you saw this a bit in the standard model course when you talk about PDFs. So here I'm colliding two gluons, and here I have a gluon, and I can imagine my gluon connecting to a pair of squarks. So for supersymmetry with R parity to not be ruled out by cosmology, the lightest superpartner has to be neutral. So let's assume our lightest superpartner is a lightest neutralino. These squarks can, they might have various different kinds of decays, but one of the decays can go into a quark, and let's say the lightest neutralino and quark and lightest neutralino. So this is one example of what a supersymmetric event would look like at a collider. There are lots of other possibilities. I might have more decays along this chain or more decays along this chain. I might produce gluons, or I might produce other superpartners instead. But this is sort of, if you like, a typical type of supersymmetric event at the LHC. And remember that because of R parity, for the superpartners, when I produce them, I have to make them in pairs. And second of all, as these superpartners go down the line, whenever they decay, they have to decay always into one superpartner in the final state. So in other words, this decays a lot because my squark could go into a quark and another superpartner. So R odd, R odd, R even. And I can imagine longer decay chains with more decays. But as I go down the decay chain, I always keep one superpartner going. And I go down the chain, and the chain has to terminate once I get to the lightest superpartner. So this is a one-step chain. A different chain that you can imagine that would be longer is I could look at my, let's say I made the gluino, the superpartner of the gluon. This state could decay to a quark and a squark. And then the squark could decay to a quark and the lightest superpartner. So this is an example of another longer decay chain. And in general, we call these decay chains cascades. So you make superpartners, and then they decay down by releasing Stutter model particles until you get to the LSP, the lightest superpartner. So
yesterday you mentioned that if the lightest superpartner is neutral, like it is good candidate for the dark matter. But how can we go other way? Like how cosmology kind of prevents the LSP is not charge neutral?
So if you have massive stable charge particles, they do cause all kinds of bad things. So one thing that can happen is that they can bind into anomalously heavy isotopes. And people have looked for them and haven't found them. But this is one of a string of long constraints on either electrically charged or colored stable particles. This is a whole other discussion that I want to get into, but just the punchline is that these things are very, very strongly ruled out by various cosmological and lab experiments. So here I'm assuming the lightest superpartner is the lightest neutralino, and I cascade down. So if I think about what I would actually see in my detector, these lightest superpartners don't have any electric charge. They don't have any color charge. They might have a little bit of weak charge, but weakly interacting things don't tend to interact with detectors. So if you think about neutrinos in a particle detector, unless you have a very specialized neutrino detector, they typically just pass right through. And the same thing applies for these LSPs. Because they only have weak interactions, they don't interact strongly enough with detectors at the LHC for the detectors to pick them up. So these things just go out of the detector and leave everything. So I can think about this collision. This collision is happening in the proton-proton center of mass frame. But because the colliding gluons that are actually doing the so-called hard collision don't carry the full proton momentum, we don't necessarily know. It doesn't happen in our lab frame in the center of mass frame of the two colliding gluons. So in principle, these two gluons can have a longitudinal boost along the direction of the beam axis. And we don't know what that boost is from the start. But what we do know is, to a very good approximation, these initial gluons are going parallel to the beam. So they're going down the beam, and they don't have any transverse momentum components. So what we can apply is energy is momentum conservation in the plane transverse to the colliding beams. So we can't apply it longitudinally because we don't know, because these states might have a net boost along the beam axis, but they shouldn't have any net boost perpendicular to it. So if I look at this particular event, what I see in my detector is a quark and a quark, but I don't see these objects. So I think you also cover this in the standard model, of course. You don't actually see individual quarks, you see jets. So if I look at my detector, or I should say if I look at a slice of my detector in the plane transverse to the beam, so here's the beam coming in, and the beam's coming in like this, and they're smashing together. This is the transverse plane. What I'm going to see is one jet. So just one column made a jet here. Here's jet one. And in general, I'll see some second jet here, jet two. But then on top of these visible jets, some of the momentum in the event is also going to be carried away by these neutralinos. So for example, I can imagine that I have something like this. So what I actually see in my detector, though, isn't the whole thing. I don't see all these components. I only see the momentum component corresponding to this and the momentum component corresponding to that. And if I sum up the so-called visible momenta, I see the vector sum, which is going to be something like this, that I'm going to call PT. So PT is the sum of all visible momenta in my detector. And the important point is this PT is in general non-zero. And it's non-zero because some of the transverse momentum is being carried off by these neutralinos. So a standard supersymmetry search is I define the so-called missing transverse momentum, or missing transverse energy, to be the sum over all visible things of the transverse momenta of all the things, of all the visible transverse momentum I see. So in other words, this PTI is the sum of this PTI plus that PT. So this is the total thing. And then, actually, sorry, there's a minus sign. So I see some net PT, and then I define the missing transverse momentum as the minus of that. So a typical supersymmetric signature, or one of the most promising supersymmetric signatures we look for at the LHC, is so-called jets plus missing energy. So you look for, and I should say that missing energy, or MET, is just the magnitude of the missing momentum. So the signal of supersymmetry that is looked for, I'll say most strongly, are sets of jets and maybe some leptons and missing energy. So the missing energy is the key feature here, and it comes about because we have these stable LSP particles. And when you apply this to, so I'm actually going to draw a slightly different plot compared to what's in my notes, but you can apply these searches, and you can rule out things like the existence of scalar quarks or squarks as a function of their mass. But these limits depend on the relative mass of the squark you're looking for, or gluino, versus the LSP mass. So because I'm implicitly assuming the chi 01 is the LSP, that means that because of that, this assumption, I have to live below this red line. Because below this red line, my squark is heavier than this. And above it, my squark is lighter than what I'm assuming is the LSP. So just my initial assumption is that I have to live below this red line. Now, the searches for jets plus missing energy tend to look something like this, and they extend all the way out to roughly, I don't know, order 1.5 TeV. So now, the reason for this shape, so the excluded range is everything shaded here. So if I think about living kind of down over here, my scork is much, much heavier than my LSP. And when it decays, when this state decays into an LSP and a quark, this LSP, because it's very light, means that these states are, to a pretty good approximation, massless compared to the mass of this object. And that means that this jet comes rocketing out with a lot of energy. And correspondingly, I end up getting a fair bit of missing energy. So if I'm living down here, I get very strong constraints. But as I start going up here towards the degeneracy line, so this degeneracy line corresponds to M squark M pi 01. What ends up happening is that my squark decays into a quark and the LSP. But if this state is very close in mass to this state, this quark just comes dribbling out with almost no energy at all. And in fact, in the limit where this state becomes degenerate with the LSP, the energy of this jet goes to zero, and you also get zero missing energy. Just because the missing energy is the sum of the energies of the visible things, and as the energies of those visible things become small, so too does the missing energy. So because of this, you end up getting, if you like, a bit of a gap close to the degeneracy line. But the size of the gap is very small, and there's typically no good theoretical reason for these states to be degenerate. So people typically quote limits on squark masses on the order of 1.5 TeV, but it is good to keep in mind that there can be, in some cases, a few loopholes to those limits. But in any case, the LHC is making great progress on looking for supersymmetry, or I should say, at least so far, it's made great progress on ruling it out. But there's still a lot more searching to be done, and we're still not quite, the limits are still not quite high enough that we're ready to give up on it.
Yeah. So if you do find the particle with transverse missing momentum, how do we know it's a supersymmetric particle but not, say, dark matter?
Yes, yeah, so that's a good question that there have been a lot of papers written about. So at least if we just see a signal of missing energy, excess missing energy, we can't say right off the bat that it's supersymmetry. We can go the other direction. We can say that supersymmetry with R parity does predict missing energy. But after you make a discovery, it's a bit like the Higgs. After you find something new, you go back and you measure it very carefully, and you try to see whether this new signal would be fit well by supersymmetric theory. There are actually some other games you can play where you could actually have access to the spins of these states. So there are other theories that give you missing energy that have different spins. So for example, if you do very, very precise measurements, you might be able to figure out the spins of these states and argue that they correspond to squarks instead of some kind of like quark partners.
Does the LHC measure the polarization of the found states?
No. Basically, no. There are a few tricks you can try to play, but essentially, no. But the spins come in and give you different angular distributions. So usually you look at how the relative angles between the two squarks or the two quarks coming out are distributed. But yeah, but the spin determinations are really, really hard. Whereas something like a linear collider, where you're colliding electrons and positrons in a center of mass frame, where you can even polarize those initial beams, gives you a lot more control for these precision measurements. But it's kind of a case of the LHC is the discovery machine, and something like a linear collider is more of a precision collider. So they're complementary in that sense. Okay. So I want to wrap up on supersymmetry on this and go to my next topic. But you'll get some more practice with supersymmetry on the homework. So I just posted the homework. Let me just mention that I spoke about superfields. I spoke about chiral superfields and vector superfields. And there's a sense in which you can think about supersymmetry as corresponding to an extension of the standard model to extra dimensions, but where the extra dimensions are fermionic coordinates or Grassmann coordinates. And this extra dimensional space is sometimes called superspace. And okay, so I'll just mention this quickly in passing. Roughly, the idea is a superfield corresponds to a function on superspace, where x is the usual space-time coordinate, and theta bar are new Grassmann-valued superspace coordinates. So this is your new set of coordinates. And supersymmetry acts on these fields as a coordinate representation in the sense that, the X transformation is a bit complicated. But roughly, it looks like the superfield just goes to a translation of the superfield. And the action of supersymmetry acts as just translations in the superspace. So this is something you've actually already seen to some extent for the translation part of the Poincaré group. If you think about the Poincaré group, or the translation part of the Poincaré group, a translation takes 5x, goes to 5x minus a, which you can think of as e to the I a mu p mu 5x. So you've already seen these so-called coordinate representations in the case of translations, in that the way we represent the p mus on fields is often with an I del mu. And you can show, you'll show in the homework that an I del mu put in this way translates your field into this. You can do the same thing with supersymmetry, and you can get a representation of the supersymmetry algebra in the form of translations on superfields. So okay, I realize I may be being a bit cryptic here, but you'll get to see an explicit toy model of that in the homework. And the toy model shares, the toy model applies to one dimension, but a similar story goes through for four dimensions in a slightly more complicated way. Okay, in any case, I want to move on.
Why is it so difficult to as we did for the neutrino? I mean, neutrino was light, quickly interacting particle, but that is much heavier quickly interacting particle. So why don't we just modify the neutrino detecting device to directly measure the LSP?
So this is what dark matter experiments, a lot of dark matter experiments are actually trying to do. There are two challenges. The first is that we have a large neutrino flux, either from nuclear reactors or accelerators or the sun, whereas we don't necessarily have a good flux of LSPs. So the LSP flux is a lot lower, so you'd have a lot fewer events. The other thing is that in the case of regular dark matter searches, we think the dark matter around us, if it's some kind of supersymmetric LSP, isn't going very fast. Whereas the neutrinos we get are very relativistic. And it turns out that this changes the scattering dynamics, and it can make it a little bit harder to see. But yeah, it essentially comes down to a matter of rates. But in any case, the thing I want to move on to next is strong dynamics. And the idea of strong dynamics is that, the original idea of using strong dynamics was to use them to break electroweak symmetry without a Higgs. And theories of this kind go by the name of technicolor. But since we found a Higgs, these minimal technicolor theories are ruled out. But extensions of them, in which the Higgs boson isn't a composite scalar, it isn't a fundamental scalar, but is instead a composite bound state of some more fundamental objects, can come about through these theories as well. So I want to talk a little bit about strong dynamics. And I'm going to start off with strong dynamics in the standard model. So I spoke to Sean, and he told me that he didn't do much about pions as Goldstone bosons. So I want to tell you this story, just starting with regular QCD and talking about pions, then scale it up to so-called theories of technicolor, and then try to connect this to theories where the Higgs is a composite object. But the first bit is, we'll start with QCD, and I guess you've all studied QCD. And the QCD Lagrangian just has the usual gauge piece. And then you have a sum over quarks, q bar I gamma mu d mu minus mi qi. And And OK, so you know how all this stuff works. But the thing I want to write down just explicitly are the sets of the quark masses. So the up quark mass turns out to be roughly 2.5 MeV. The down quark mass turns out to be about 5.3 MeV. The charm mass and the strange mass, let's see, strange mass is about 110 MeV. The charm mass is 1.25 GeV. And then the bottom, okay, I'll do the bottom and top. The top is about 173 GeV. And the bottom mass is, what do I have it listed, about 4.5 GeV. So we have this wide range of masses. And this is supposed to be a 5, sorry. So we have these masses, but these masses are interesting compared to the scale at which the QCD coupling becomes strong. So what I mean by this is, let's look at the strength of the QCD gauge coupling as you vary the energy. So you've done renormalization group stuff, so hopefully this is fairly familiar. So if I look at the running of the strong coupling, dg dt, at one loop, it takes the form minus b over 4 pi squared g cubed. And b for QCD is 11 minus essentially 2/3 times the number of flavors, where number of flavors is equal to so recall that this t is log mu with respect to some reference value of mu. So mu is the scale. So I'm varying the mu, this mu scale. And as I vary the mu scale, the coupling varies in this way, where t is the log of the mu scale. And the value that I use for the so-called beta function coefficient turns out to be 11 minus 2/3 times the number of light flavors. So in other words, as I run down in energy, as I go below the mass of a certain quark, it stops contributing to the beta function. OK, but in any case, I see that, well, first of all, if I include all the quarks, this is a positive number, which means that this total b is a positive number, which means the minus sign gives me a gauge coupling that goes to 0 as I go to higher and higher energies. So this is called asymptotic freedom. So as long as we only have the known quarks, as I take mu to infinity, the running coupling goes to 0. So the strong force becomes weaker and weaker and weaker as I go to higher and higher energies. On the other hand, going to lower and lower energies, it becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. So as a reference, I'm going to use alpha s at the z mass. And this is measured to be about 0.118. Where alpha s is just, in this case, g squared over 4 pi. OK, so I can rewrite this in terms of alpha. And it turns out that the general solution is alpha s of mu, alpha s inverse of mu 0, plus b over 2 pi log mu over mu naught, which if I look at this and I look at this, this is positive. And let's say I take my mu naught to be mz. So I'll take my mu naught to be mz just because it's where we've measured this thing very well. Now, suppose I take my mu and I look at it going to lower and lower energies. Going to lower and lower energies, from mu below mz, this log becomes negative. The coefficient is positive, and this piece starts canceling off against this piece. And it turns out that if I go to low enough energy, this piece cancels off against this piece entirely, corresponding to the running coupling blowing up. Or put another way, I can rewrite my alpha s of mu in terms of the scale lambda where the coupling blows up as 2 pi over b log mu or lambda QCD, where lambda QCD is defined as a scale goes to infinity. So in other words, for mu equals lambda QCD, this thing cancels this exactly, corresponding formally to my alpha s going to infinity. So in pictures, what's happening is I have some scale that I call lambda QCD. Here's my alpha s. Here's my mu. And this is my lambda QCD scale. And my strong coupling looks something like that. So my strong coupling at high energies at large mu goes small, but it blows up at this lambda QCD. So here, I've only computed at one loop. And of course, as my gauge coupling becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, the one loop approximation becomes a bad approximation. But what we can say is that at some scale, lambda QCD, and numerically, this lambda QCD is on the order of about 200 MeV. At the scale approaching lambda QCD, the strong coupling becomes very strong. And what ends up happening is confinement. And by confinement, this corresponds to quarks and gluons and antiquarks binding into exclusively color-neutral objects. So what we see at low energies is different from what we see at high energies. So at high energies, on this side of the coupling blowing up, we see Q, Q bar, and gluon. Whereas at low energies, what we see primarily are mesons, I'll call M, and baryons that I'll call B. So a meson, it turns out, has a net quantum numbers of a quark antiquark bound state. And a baryon has the quantum numbers of a net quark 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 bound state. So my meson corresponds to q bar I, qj, delta ij. And a baryon corresponds to a qi, qj, qk, epsilon ijk. Or put another way, just the invariant tensors of, in this case, SU3. So the way confinement actually works is a big problem. So we don't know how to compute it analytically. But what we can do is take QCD in this form, put it on a lattice, and simulate it numerically. And we find that numerically confinement occurs. And in fact, if you work very carefully, you can actually make predictions for the masses of mesons and baryons. So even though we don't understand this confinement process entirely analytically, we have a good numerical handle on it. And this picture agrees with what we observe experimentally. Now, what I'd like to do when talking about strong coupling is think about this side of lambda QCD versus this side of lambda QCD. So on this side of lambda QCD, as long as we go out to fairly high energies, we have effectively a perturbative field theory that we can describe in terms of quarks and gluons. Yep.
So, I mean, do we have any qualitative picture of what happens during confinement, or maybe not exactly numerically?
I'll try to say something about that in a minute. It'll just be a cartoon, but we have a good cartoon at least. Okay, so anyway, so we know how to describe the theory over here. We have this theory of quarks and gluons. It's just a non-abelian gauge theory, and we know how to do perturbation theory on that. What we'd like down here, though, is to write an effective field theory. So we want to write an effective field theory formulated in terms of the of fields corresponding to particles we see, in particular in terms of baryons and mesons. And in principle, if we knew how to do that, if we knew how to compute through confinement, we could start with this theory and compute what this effective field theory should be. Unfortunately, because it's strong coupling, we don't know how to do that analytically. But we can still say a few things about the form of the low energy theory. By matching up symmetries on this side of confinement to this side of confinement. So that's what I want to spend some time on next. But just quickly, One way to think about confinement now, this is just a bit of a cartoon, but one way to think about confinement is, suppose I take a quark and an antiquark close together and I try to pull them apart. So when they're close together, that corresponds to short distances. That corresponds roughly to large energies. So at short distances, the effect of interaction between them is fairly weak and is described by the exchange of gluons. So at short distances, my effective potential between the two, between the quark-antiquark pair, it just corresponds to exchanging some gluons back and forth. So at short distances, I expect it to look something like alpha s over r. So something essentially Coulombic at short distances. So there are logarithmic corrections to this from the running, but OK, it's a small correction. On the other hand, as I start to pull these states farther and farther apart, what ends up happening, or the cartoon picture, is that if you were to think about electromagnetism and let's say a positive and a negative charge, you'd have flux lines between them. So you have flux lines. So the usual flux line story. What seems to happen in a non-abelian gauge theory is instead of these flux lines spreading apart, and for a point charge, the amount of spreading in an abelian gauge theory goes like 1 over r squared. So it's like water shooting out of a nozzle and just spreading out with the area. What seems to happen in QCD is instead of the flux lines spreading out a lot, they seem to instead concentrate very strongly between the two charges, so they don't spread out in the same way. So instead of these flux lines spreading out and getting what corresponds to Coulomb potential with 1 over r, there's a correction from the fact that they tend to confine into what ends up looking like a so-called flux tube. So if you make the distance large enough, it looks like all these field lines are just confined into a flux tube to a very good approximation. And as you start to pull this apart, because everything's combined and not spreading out, it turns out that you get I don't want to write that. Your potential ends up having a linear piece. So I have a to get the dimensions of this right, it turns out that this linear piece goes like lambda QCD, what is it, squared, I think. So this is dimensions of mass. And this is dimensions of mass to the minus 1, so mass, yeah. So it goes like lambda QCD squared. So the picture is that now I have my flux lines in a tube, confined in a tube. And in fact, the very start of string theory came about from people trying to describe flux tubes in QCD. So string theory was, as far as I know, first formulated as a way to describe flux tubes and as an attempt for confinement. Now, within this picture, as I start to pull these things farther and farther apart, my energy becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. But now I can go and look at my masses of quarks. And at least for the up and down quarks, my up and down quarks are very light compared to lambda QCD. So lambda QCD is about 200 MeV, whereas my quark masses are more like 1 or 2 MeV, or sorry, 2 to 5 MeV, at least for these light states. So that means that relative to the energy density you get in the flux tube, whose natural scale is set by lambda QCD, the energy it takes to nucleate a quark-antiquark pair is only a few MeV. It's much less than that. So what ends up happening is, as I stretch this farther and farther apart, the energy density gets bigger and bigger and bigger until I hit a point where it becomes energetically favorable. So here's my quark. Here's my antiquark. Oops. Here's my quark. Here's my antiquark. It becomes energetically favorable to nucleate, let's say, an up, anti-up, or down, anti-down pair. And these states are connected by flux tubes. So what happens here is now I'm pulling these states apart, but if you like, my flux tube snapped, and these two ends come together. And these pieces combine into form one meson, And these pieces combine to form two mesons. So the point is that as I pull two a quark-antiquark pair apart, instead of just getting them farther and farther apart with less and less interaction, like I would for, let's say, an electron and a positron, what I get instead is my flux tube breaks, and I get a pair of mesons that are both color neutral. So this is, if you like, the cartoon picture of confinement, that these color charges, as you pull them apart, are stay connected by flux tubes. And the flux tubes, because they have a large energy density, as you start to stretch them a lot, compared to the light quark masses, you just nucleate the light quarks, and things glump together. OK. So this is a, I want to emphasize that this is just a very rough cartoon of confinement. But it turns out that when you simulate the story on the lattice, something very similar to this happens. OK. So what I want to move on to next, though, is to try to figure out a way to describe at least some part of this effective theory below lambda QCD. So we're going to have to use some tricks. We can't just do Feynman diagrams and integrate out a heavy particle explicitly like we did previously. Instead, we're going to have to rely on some other things. And the other things we're going to rely on are symmetries. So in particular, the active confinement shouldn't break any symmetries explicitly. It might break some symmetries spontaneously, but it shouldn't break any explicitly. And we're going to use this to build a theory of at least light mesons that matches up well with experiment. OK, so the starting point for this is to examine our original QCD Lagrangian. And let's focus on the original QCD Lagrangian, specifically in the limit where I only have an up quark and a down quark. So let's concentrate on QCD with only an up and a down. And then I'll come back later and talk about how to put in the extra quarks. But if I look at the up and down quarks, those are the ones that are really light compared to lambda QCD. The strange quark, it might be relevant. But the other heavier quarks are a fair bit heavier. So if I want to describe physics below, let's say, 200 MeV, the up and the down quark are certainly relevant, maybe the strange, but the charm top and bottom are much heavier. And I should be able to integrate them out of my theory beforehand. OK, so let's start off with QCD with the so-called two flavors. And if we look at our Lagrangian, I can rewrite the Lagrangian in a suggestive way. So I still have the usual gauge part. But for the quark part, I can rewrite it in the following form. Q bar L, Q bar L, I gamma mu, d mu, Q L, cos Q bar R, I gamma mu, d mu, Q R, minus M, Q bar L. So what I mean by this notation is the Q left right corresponds to me putting the up and down quarks, or the left and right handed components, into doublets. So Q left is up left down left, and Q right is up right down right. This piece, this M, corresponds to just the matrix with M up, M down on the diagonal. And the same thing for here. So if we take the characteristic scale, where the couplings become strong to be lambda QCD, which is about 200 MeV, these mass terms are going to be small corrections, in the sense that the mass piece is very small compared to lambda QCD. So for the time being, let's ignore this part. So let's ignore this part, and then we'll come back later and put it in as a small perturbation. So in this picture, we have left-handed quarks, right-handed quarks, and we're ignoring their masses. And then we have the gluon fields. And It turns out that this theory has a set of symmetries. And this theory has a set of symmetries. In particular, my Q left can be transformed by in the following way. So I can apply the following transformations to my theory. At least at the level of Lagrangian, I can do equal phase rescalings on Q left and Q right. And that works, obviously. I can do I can do the same phasing, or I can do the opposite rephasing. Or put another way, I can do independent rephasings of Q left and Q right. And I can parameterize it in this way and this way. And then I can also do independent left-handed, so-called left-handed SE2 transformations and right-handed SE2 transformations on Q left and Q right. So at the level of this Lagrangian, I have this set of symmetries. So we say that at the level of Lagrangian, we have SE2 left cross SE2 right cross U1V cross U1A as a set of symmetries of this Lagrangian ignoring the mass terms. OK, so I'm going to call, so we have this set of symmetries, at least at the level of classical Lagrangian. It turns out that if you compute at the quantum level, this A part turns out to be anomalous. So it turns out that quantum corrections explicitly violate this U1A. So it's not actually a symmetry of the quantum theory. So did you discuss anomalies at all in standard model? OK. I don't think I'm going to have time to discuss them much myself. But OK. But it turns out that this is not actually a symmetry of the quantum theory. And a way to understand that is, even though it seems to be a symmetry of my action, in this sense, to formulate a quantum theory, I would formulate a quantum theory, for example, in terms of a path interval. And when I do a transformation, I have to do a transformation on the action. And I also have to do a transformation on the path integral measure. So if I look at just the action, if the action is invariant under the transformation, that's good. But I also have to make sure that my path integral measure is also invariant under the transformation. And it turns out that for most symmetries, it seems to be symmetries of the action. They typically also leave the path integral measure invariant, but there are a few special ones that don't. And one of the special ones that doesn't corresponds in this case to the U1A. So we're going to ignore this one for the time being. The story of anomalies is very interesting and deep and useful, but I'm not going to have time to get into it. So just for the time being, we're going to ignore this piece because it turns out to be broken at the quantum level. And I'm going to take this remainder part and identify this as the symmetry group of my low energy effective QCD theory. And I'm going to call this G sub flav. So the flav corresponds to flavor. And we call it flavor because these SU2 transformations mix the different up and down flavors. OK, so this set of symmetries is the one that we want to encode in our low energy effective theory. And these symmetries, we expect them to be preserved, or we expect them to be not broken explicitly by confinement. There's no reason for confinement to break them explicitly. But it is possible for confinement to break some subset of them spontaneously. And that's what we'll see in a second. Okay, so that's the first piece. The second piece is something that gives the right answer in terms of theory, but it's also verified on the lattice. And that is that if I look at this combination, and if I look at its matrix element, where the j and the I correspond to the SE2 indices, ij go from 1 and 2, it turns out that this thing is non-zero. And it corresponds roughly to lambda QCD cubed times delta ij. So it turns out that this Quark bilinear has a non-zero matrix element because of confinement that goes like lambda QCD cubed. So this isn't something that we can say from the perturbative point of view. It turns out that it is something we find on the lattice. And we'll also see how this corresponds to giving an interesting spectrum that matches up with a realistic low-energy QC theory in a second. Yeah.
So I guess the form of this two-point function is just determined by the SE2 symmetry rate. Very good theory. It's just the lambda. It's just the coefficient is determined by.
So it has to be consistent. Let me put it a different way. We can choose our basis of fields by doing SE2 transformations to put this bilinear in this form.
Okay.
But we're still stuck with the delta ij and the lambda QCD.
Okay.
So given this, though, let's look at what happens to the flavor group when applied to this vacuum expectation value. And we see that, and this shouldn't be too much of a surprise, that the combination lambda QCD cubed, delta, I can think of my delta ij as a unit matrix, so I'll just write it as 1, transforms if I apply the left and right transformations to a right to Q right and a left to Q left, this thing goes to R dagger as 1 times left, which is just obviously lambda QCD cubed, R dagger left. And again, all I'm doing is I could write this as So this goes to LQ, this goes to Q bar R dagger, and I get this. So this is obviously not equal to what I started with. So in other words, this vacuum expectation value is not consistent, is not left invariant by the symmetry transformations. And because of this, some fraction of our flavor symmetry is spontaneously broken. So this QCD non-zero Quark bilinear matrix element spontaneously breaks some fraction of the flavor group. And okay, so I could also apply these U1V transformations. If you apply U1V, the vacuum's invariant, and the vacuum's invariant because I get the same phase here with opposite sides, and those cancel out. So the U1V is just fine, but the SU2 left cross SU2 right is non-invariant. However, there's a subgroup of SU2 left cross SU2 right that is left invariant. And that corresponds to the subgroup of SU2 left and SU2 right that we call SU2V. So SU2V is a subgroup of SU2 left cross SU2 right. And this corresponds to transformations under left and right such that the left and right-handed transformations are the same. So obviously, if I do the same left-handed transformation as a right-handed transformation, this thing becomes the unit matrix, and I get back unity. So the story is that the U1V isn't touched by this Quark bilinear expectation value. But some fraction of the SU2 left cross SU2 right global symmetry is broken. And the part that's left unbroken, the maximal part that's left unbroken, corresponds to the so-called SE2V subgroup. So what we say, what we say is that we have a spontaneous breaking of SE2 left cross SE2 right cross U1V to SE2V cross U1V.
We had this from the very beginning if we started with the mass terms, right? So the mass terms are also compatible with this SE2V symmetry, right? So we start with this entire Lagrangian, we just write down the SE2 transformation.
But sorry, the mass terms, so unless M up, they're not unless M up and M down are equal to each other.
Because
it's not, yeah. Okay, but we're going to come back and treat those as perturbations, and the perturbation parameter is going to be essentially the mass, okay, I covered up the mass, but it's going to be the mass over lambda QCD. So there's a sense in which I can treat the masses as small perturbations, and we'll come back to that. Okay, but in any case, I'm going to call this G flavor, and I'm going to call this H flavor. So G is broken down to its subgroup H. And the general story of a spontaneous breaking of a continuous symmetry into a subgroup is that you get a Goldstone boson for every broken generator. So I started with, if I look at the number of generators, I have one U1 generator, three SU2, three SU2. So I have a total on this side of seven generators. And I have a total on this side of four generators. So that means that I have that means that I have three broken generators. And these correspond, sometimes people talk about G mod H. These three broken generators, this is just fancy language, but the three broken generators are going to correspond to three Nambu-Goldstone bosons. Or NGBs. So if I think about getting Goldstone bosons, and I think about symmetry breaking, when you have symmetry breaking, what typically happens is you get heavy modes, and you get massless Goldstones. So the typical mass of the heavy modes from symmetry breaking is on the order of the dimensionful scale of that symmetry breaking. So in this case, the dimensionful scale of that symmetry breaking is somewhere around lambda QCD. Whereas light degrees of freedom, the ones that are going to be much lighter than lambda QCD will be these Goldstone bosons. So that means that a good candidate for our effective field theory applied to very, very low energies, well below lambda QCD, should be a theory of exclusively containing the Nambu-Goldstone bosons. So the picture is that we're going to integrate out the stuff that gets masses around lambda QCD, and we're going to write an effective field theory for the light Nambu-Goldstone bosons corresponding to this spontaneous symmetry breaking. So we're going to make use of that. And we're going to make use of the fact that the low energy theory and the high energy theory share the same symmetries, even if in the low energy theory I have a spontaneous breaking of that symmetry.
So the four degrees of freedom which are massive that we're integrating out, are they also like mesons? Not mesons, but I mean quark anti-quark condensates.
From this point of view, we don't know and we don't necessarily care. There are going to be some complicated things that I probably don't really know how to compute, at least not analytically. So I'm essentially focusing on the things that I have some kind of analytic control over, and that turns out to be these Nambu-Goldstone bosons. OK, so the way we're going to do this, I think you saw a version of this in one of the earlier homework questions. One way to write down a theory of Nambu-Goldstone bosons is to expand your field in a form that looks like the vacuum configuration. So what I mean by this, what we're going to do here is we're going to use a set of fields that I'm going to call sigma of x. And sigma of x I'm going to write in the following form. It's going to be some exponential of I pi a of x ta over f. So f is some dimensionful scale, and we'll come back and try to figure out what this is in a second. The pi A's are a set of three fields that are going to correspond to my three number Goldstone bosons. And my TA are just the sigma matrices, sigma A over 2. So the way to think about this is this sigma looks like this sigma takes the form of an SE2 transformation. But the parameters of the SE2 transformation, now instead of just being transformation parameters that don't depend on space-time, are now fields. And a way to get Goldstone bosons is to think about, or one way to parameterize them is to write them in the form of symmetry transformations parameterized by fields acting on the vacuum. So specifically, we're going to take this thing and treat it as transforming like the vacuum. And what I mean by this is we're going to assume that under SU2, under the set of symmetries, this thing goes to L sigma x r dagger, which happens to be the same transformation property as a vacuum.
So is it obvious that this is SU2? I mean, if we divide out H flavor out of G flavor, then it has to be SU2 because of this product structure, or?
So okay, the way I get the H flavor out of this, so the G and H just come from looking at what remains invariant. And the maximal thing that's left invariant by this vacuum structure, which I can write this way, is this so-called vector subgroup.
But here we have G flavor, not H flavor, on the sigma x.
Yeah, so we'll see how this pans out in a second. So at this point, this probably looks a little bit funny. But as I work through it, hopefully it'll become clear and clearer why this is a useful form to express a theory of Goldstone bosons in terms of. So at this point, I want to write down a theory with three fields, three number Goldstone boson fields. So at least the number of fields here works out right. And we're going to see that the symmetry transformation properties of those Goldstone boson fields are going to work out in a nice way if I define it with this and this. So this should become a bit clearer as we work along. And I think the homework problem that is in the new homework will also give another illustration of this. So we're going to assume that this field transforms under SU2 left cross SU2 right transformations in this way. And the reason I have both left and right is, if you recall, in a theory of spontaneous symmetry breaking, even though my full symmetry isn't obviously there, it still happens to be there in a hidden way. And it's still there in a hidden way in the sense that, and I think we spoke about this in the first week, it can still be realized through nonlinear transformations on the fields. So normally when we say a symmetry is unbroken, that means that we can realize it linearly. When it's spontaneously broken, it's still there, but it's realized nonlinearly. And we'll see that the vector subgroup will be realized linearly on these fields, and the broken part corresponding to the broken generators will correspond to a nonlinear shift in the pi fields. Okay. So in terms of L and R, these are two independent SU2 matrices. But it turns out that we can parameterize them in sort of a semi-useful way as follows. So this is just a particular parameterization of general SU2 fields. TB. Okay, so this is just a way to parameterize these two independent SU2 matrices. But the reason it's useful is that if I have CA, all zero, this just corresponds to an SU2V transformation. So in other words, left is equal to right, provided the CAs are zero. Whereas if the CVs are both zero, I obviously don't have an SU2V transformation. And this gives a parameterization of the stuff that doesn't lie in the SU2V subgroup. So if you like, this is kind of the V part And this part is going to turn out to be corresponding to the broken part. OK, so if you want to apply an SE2V transformation, we set the CAs equal to 0. So if I do that, my sigma now goes to V sigma V dagger. And what I can do is take my exponential, write it out as a power series. And then in each term of the power series, whenever I have one of these terms, between each power, I can insert a VV dagger. And that means that, by inserting these things and reconnecting the exponential, this thing turns out to be just the exponential of 2i pi a v t a v dagger over f. So all I've done here is, I'll leave this for you to go home and prove. But the idea is you take this, you expand out the exponential. I have my v and v daggers. I insert a bunch of unities in the form of vv dagger. And I can rewrite this thing this way by collecting all the terms and putting them back together.
But what about a factor between the exponential?
Oh, sorry, there should be a 2 here. OK, so now if you look at this, this means that with this transformation, if we expand it in an infinitesimal form, we'll be able to pull out the infinitesimal transformation of pi a. So it turns out that if I write my if I write my v as 1 plus I CVB TB plus dot dot dot, this is the infinitesimal transformation. And you can show that at the level of infinitesimal transformations, pi a goes to pi a prime, which at the infinitesimal level is delta AC minus F ABC CVB pi C plus an order CV squared. So what we see from this is, what we see from this specifically is that under these V transformations, my pi's transform linearly. And in particular, they transform linearly under the adjoint representation of the group. So this corresponds to an infinitesimal adjoint transformation on this triplet pi c. And this makes sense. I have three objects. If they're going to transform linearly under SU2, and there are three components, it better be under the adjoint, where I have three things. So under these SU2V transformations, I realize the symmetry linearly in the sense that I can think of pi a ta going to pi a vta v dagger, which corresponds to this linear transformation here. On the other hand, if I apply a transformation with, let's say, cv equals to 0, but non-zero ca, what ends up happening is my pi transforms to a pi prime. Let me just put this up a sec. My pi goes to a pi prime, and this takes a bit of work to show, plus f CAA TA plus order CA squared. So what I see now as the infinitesimal transformation from the pieces corresponding to broken generators, the pieces corresponding to CV equals to 0, but the other stuff, is that under these, if you like, broken generators, my field transforms non-linearly, in that my field transforms into, that should be pi. So this is what we call pi prime. This field transforms.
Is the second term contain no pi field?
Actually, sorry, maybe. Yeah, that's the whole point. It's non-linear. So this is a non-linear shift. So this is still a symmetry of the theory. We're going to build it in as a symmetry of the theory. But we see that under this spontaneously broken symmetry, my pi fields transform as a shift. And this is characteristic of Goldstone bosons.
Okay.
So if you go back, and I think in the first set of notes, we have a discussion of Goldstone bosons, and we show that in the case of just breaking a spontaneous U1, you can show that the Goldstone boson, in a certain parameterization, can be understood as transforming in the effective theory by just a shift. So we're seeing the same thing here. And what we're going to do at the end of our day for our theory is that since we're spontaneously breaking the symmetry and not explicitly breaking it, our full symmetry should still be realized in the low energy effective theory, but it's spontaneously broken, so it should be realized nonlinearly. So this is what we're going to build into our effective theory. Our effective theory will be invariant under the full SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1V, but it's going to have a built-in, and it's going to realize the V part linearly, corresponding to the unbroken part, and it's going to realize the broken part nonlinearly. So you'll get to fiddle with a bit of this over the homework, and I'll talk more about it on Monday.